Hello there. I am your co-host, David Brook, for the AIPT Comics podcast. And with me is my other co-host, Forrest Hollingsworth.
Hello. I am Forrest with two R's, and this is the 21st episode of the AIPT Comics podcast, which means that our podcast is old enough to drink, but I won't let it. And you know why that is, Dave?
Why is it?
I'm a Quaker.
Oh my God, I didn't know. We've done 21 or so hours of this podcast that I didn't know you were a Quaker.
I would bet that there are still Quakers in the world. Actually, I'm positive that there are still Quakers in the world. But I would also be confident that they don't listen to this podcast, so I felt comfortable making that joke.
How do you record without electricity?
Echoes.
Is there a horse like pulling something that makes it go?
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, this is a comics podcast, not a Quaker podcast, and we talk about our favorite books.
This isn't for them.
From last week. We talk about the latest comic book news, and we talk about what's coming out next week, as well as have some fun segments where we have heroes fight each other for shits and giggles.
Our entertainment.
Yes, exactly. And every show starts with the news, and this week we have a ton of news to talk about. The biggest news, probably, is the fact that Grumpy Cat has died.
R.I.P.
So sad. Grumpy Cat number one obviously was a Dynamite book in 2015, and the poor kitten cat, only 7 years old, died too young.
Yeah, a real legend.
It's what everyone's talking about in the comic book community, if you were lying. Actually, the biggest news this week, Jonathan Hickman came out and talked to comicbook.com about his huge revision, I don't know, of the X-Books with Power of X and, gosh dang it, what's the other one?
House of X.
Hox
and Pox.
Yeah.
Hoxus Poxus.
Basically, Hickman, he didn't get into too much detail with comicbook.com, but he might with AIPT's X-Men Monday, because he will be answering fan questions on AIPTcomics.com. Exciting! But the news we already have, though, is that he talked to comicbook.com basically about his vision and why it needs to happen, this kind of reboot of sorts, and his approach, which he comes off very much less a writer and more of an editor, because he even goes into detail.
I absolutely thought that as well.
Yeah, because he goes into detail about like how he's actually like handpicking or being part of the process of all the books that are going to sprout from this after the 2 6-issue stories come out. Mm-hmm. And that came off as a bit shocking to me. You don't usually see a writer come out and talk in this way.
Yeah, especially like the first question they ask is, so you're back at Marvel, how'd that happen?
Right.
And he says, we got on the phone and talked about a lot of things, what I'd like to do if I came back, what he'd like for me to do, and some vertically integrated opportunities at the company.
Right.
Which I know that Hickman is a smart guy, but I was like, whoa, that seems kind of outside of the normal duties or purview of an author.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Vertical integration, leading the X-Men line, redefining a whole entire series of books. I think the broadest line at Marvel. I may be mistaken. It may be Spider-Man now.
I mean, I'm all for what he puts out. I'm not going to judge it before it comes out by any means. And actually, I have to say, reading this interview, I was kind of impressed with the idea of forcing all mutant lovers to read only these two books. In our AIPT Slack, I did point out this is sort of like kidnapping X-Men books by forcing everyone to read only his two books. But at the same time, I think it makes sense to kind of realign, rejigger, and then get everyone on the same page. But
sure.
I mean, it's all about execution, though, right?
Absolutely. And I think he makes a good case for that. You know, there's a question that kind of leads to that where it's like, you want to introduce a new era for X-Men with House of X and Powers of X. And he says, I argued for canceling the entire line.
Right.
Why it would work, why it was a good idea, and most importantly, why it was what we needed to do narratively to return the X-Men to their rightful prominent position in the Marvel Universe. And I think that that's definitely the kind of determination and the kind of like top-down view that I want a writer to have, especially if there are being a quasi-editor as well, going out and like completely redefining a line. The part that's missing for me is any kind of recognition of the other X books that are going on right now. Jordan D. White, the X-Men editor, has done a great job of that. C.B. Cebulski has done a good job of that as well. But I don't necessarily get from Hickman's own comments that he's necessarily thinking retroactively as much as I would like for him to.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we don't know the full degree to which he's been working with folks like Ed Brisson or Kelly Thompson or Matthew Rosenberg and stuff. And certainly, I think that they were probably hired on knowing that their X-books were going to end before these two miniseries started.
Right.
But Lonnie Nadler said, I see a lot of people saying none of the current X-book books matter anymore. Well, I can tell you they matter a hell of a lot to the people who work on them. All stories have merit in and of themselves, not merely based on how they lead into what's next. And obviously Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson are writing the Alpha and Omega books as well as Marvelous X-Men for the Age of X-Men event. They're devoting a lot of time and effort and energy to this. And whether or not Marvel's mandate is to just have this lead into Hoxus Poxus, I would like for Hickman to recognize that.
At the same time, though, this is serial storytelling. I mean, these characters are always changing, so don't be upset that they're rebooting things, because, I mean, that's sort of the nature of the beast.
And I'm not necessarily upset that they are.
Right.
Right? I think it's been a really long time since they've actually canceled the whole line, not carried over ideas or characters or a particular cliffhanger or hook or anything like that, right? But it just rubs me the wrong way.
I'm very excited for X-Men Monday. I think those answers are going to help us understand his vision more and possibly ease minds.
Absolutely, right. Right.
Because this interview, he comes off as a bit harsh, and it's more about how he's coming about and how this came about rather than what it is about.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think that this is where the delineation between an author and an editor is actually important.
Right.
Right? Because it's an editor's job to execute the vision of the line or to move things forward or to get creative teams all under one umbrella and operating efficiently.
Right.
And obviously Hickman thinks of his ideas and his books and his miniseries and stuff as his babies. And I want a writer to think that.
For sure. Passion.
The same as I am totally okay with Zack Snyder saying that in his view of the DC universe, Batman kills people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want a creator to believe in their vision that much.
Even if it pisses everyone off.
Right. But when you're acting at a level this high and with media properties this big, and you're talking about a book that is planned to go into fucking forever.
Yeah.
And that these miniseries or this maxi series or whatever it becomes with a flagship title that Hickman said he's going to be writing is planned all the way to the end of 2020.
Uh-huh.
I start to worry a little bit about the fact that he thinks he can lead it and also write it.
That's a lot of plates to spin.
Right. And so I really do think that when we get a chance to talk with him or put some answers out there on Monday, on the X-Men Monday article, that I think that will clear some things up.
And you know what? We might clear some things up on this very show, as next week we will have X-Men editor Jordan White on for a brief interview.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I'm very excited about that, too. I was thinking of my questions just today.
All our questions are going to be spoiler questions.
One of mine
is, does Wolverine die? Does Magneto die?
Why not
die?
B-men? Why not C-men?
Oh, my God.
Oh, I actually, never mind. I get why it's not C-men.
Wow. In other news about comics, that about how comic book storytelling always changes, Tom King came out and said that his last 16 issues of Batman will forever change the character, possibly for a generation, maybe forever. His words. A bit of a shock, because as I just said, like, none of these stories last longer than a decade, if that. Usually they don't last that long. Story choices don't last too long. Before we started recording, I told Forrest, I think Damian might be the biggest story change for Batman that's lasted as long as it has.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything else.
I think it's been a long time. You know, I think various Robins and stuff stay on as ancillary characters.
Right.
But, yeah, it's been a long time since something has truly changed the Bat verse.
What do you think is his big change? What will change Batman for possibly ever?
I think that he is going to break this kind of temporary insanity, nightmare, whatever, that Bane has him locked in right now and actually marry Catwoman.
Ah, so we'll get married Batman.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I think, you know, and I there's some editorial stuff that I've read before and even some writers and author artists and stuff saying marrying characters is a really bad idea because they instantly become boring.
Right, right.
But yeah, it seems like a good kind of full circle thing to do.
Right.
For this series. So.
And we all know the story will just lead up to the issue where Catwoman gets murdered and then Batman has to get revenge.
No doubt. Yeah. Because comics treat women really well.
Right, exactly. I mean, Invisible Woman's doing, you know, she's pretty good. She's still alive. She hasn't been fridged yet. She's getting her own book soon.
Yeah, yeah.
First ever.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think because Tom King's storyline is so focused on Bane, I think we're going to find out Bane is somehow related to Batman, Bruce Wayne. That they're either brothers or cousins or something, and that will somehow change their dynamic. It'll be something revealed to Bane that he didn't know, and Batman, obviously. And it could be an interesting story that, you know, spins out from there.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. A little bit of a Aegon Targaryen type thing going on.
Right, because Bruce has always been the only child, the only child rich kid. So let's get away from that trope and move on to, you know, stepbrothers like the movie.
Yeah. I mean, that would kind of back up what King is saying, where he says, I've been talking to not just DC, but Warner Bros. And AT&T.
Right.
Which is like a great reminder that when a character gets as big as Batman, it's not just the publisher that has a say.
Mm-mm.
Like, it's everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that may feed into the Robert Pattinson, Matt Reeves movie or whatever they want to do. But King had to run this by a ton of people. And he ended up saying, I never thought we'd get this kind of stuff approved. When you're working with a corporate character, you think you're going to have a reset. But this is a change that's going to shake the world of Batman. And it's going to leave my mark on the character. And obviously, this story is really, really inspired by Nightfall. There's a lot of Bane elements. There's a lot of, like, echoes of things that have happened between Bane and Batman in the past and stuff like that. A lot of reusing iconography and pastiches of those stories and stuff. So if it happened to impact both of them, I think that that would make a lot of sense.
Although there is also Batman's dad is alive now, right?
Thomas Wayne, yeah, from the Flashpoint
right,
universe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something to do with that.
Although maybe he will be the one to reveal that.
Could be. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Fitting.
Ah, look at that.
We got it.
Stories upon stories upon stories.
This is an absolutely crazy called shot, but if we nailed it.
Here's another idea. What if in the Walking Dead comic series, Robert Kirkman kills off Rick Grimes, but then he falls into an altered dimension where he is Batman's neighbor? And Rick is like so, you know, messed up from zombies and losing so many friends that he's like terrible. He has like pink flamingos on the lawn. He doesn't mow it. And it's like this ongoing like problem for Bruce.
Yeah.
Which leads us into our next bit of news.
That would have to run. That would have to be run by so many
yeah.
people.
Yeah, that would never happen. That's ridiculous. Yeah. But apparently in, what is it? Issue 192, Kirkman was hyping
in June.
It. Yes, June. It's a big deal. A big deal, is his own words, is going to be happening in this issue. Killing off Rick is a huge decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's like the only character still alive in that series. I guess there's still his son there.
There's a couple main characters that have stuck around, and also characters when the book has been running that long that have been upgraded to main cast
right.
at this point. But yeah, it seems likely. You know, a lot of people have been tweeting at him and he's been responding with stuff like hashtag no comment.
Right.
And stuff. So it seems really likely. They did a blank cover variant specifically for this issue because Kirkman is hyping it up to be a really, really big deal. So my guesses are either Rick Grimes will die, which seems very likely. It seems like you should bet your money on that. Or they're going to say at the end of the issue, in 50 issues, the finale of The Walking Dead.
Oh, that could be.
Or something like that. And this is based off the fact that the last time we talked about The Walking
Dead,
he said, I'm just kind of tired of this.
Right. Which was a shock to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at the very least, he was saying that he didn't really want it to be about zombies anymore. And obviously, he's pouring a lot of energy into other stories like Outcast.
Yep.
So I think that it's likely that he's going to start steering it towards whining.
It's probably become a chore for him to write this series.
I bet that it has.
I mean, it's not even that complex of a series. I mean, every issue is only... Sometimes the issues only last... There's like a 10-minute time frame in the issue. Mm-hmm. It's definitely more of a melodrama.
Yeah, and I don't fault it for that at all. I think he's a great writer, and I...
Yeah.
Man, I don't have the energy to do anything for 192 monthly anythings.
Yeah.
But, wow. It's got to be exhausting, even if you love something that much.
I think, I mean, when he started, I said this on the other show, but in the back of the book, it said something, or his foreword or the afterword, he said something about how every horror movie is only 2 hours. What if you were to make that hundreds of hours long? How would that change the people? And by the very fact that he made that point, it made me think it was an experiment.
Yeah, and maybe he's finding, you know, well, it turns out that that's not that interesting.
Right.
Even to me.
Right.
And that's totally fair, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's run out of ideas when it comes to the zombies, that's for sure. It's always kind of been about the characters, though.
Absolutely. And any good book should be.
Right.
Yeah.
Just like Marvel revealing that the Power Pack is coming back. It's going to be all about character.
Yeah.
And also, DC's bringing back the Wildcats, which is kind of cool.
Yes. So... Power Pack is with the OG creators, Louis Simonson and June Brigman, who originally debuted the Power Pack in a 1984 issue that ended up running for 62 issues. There was a follow-up four-issue Power Pack series in 2000, and then another one in 2005. But it's been a really long time since there's been a story called Power Pack. And actually, Hickman, when his interview with comicbook.com that we were quoting earlier came out, he quote tweeted it on Twitter and said, "Who cares about this Power Pack?"
Yep.
Which I thought was pretty funny.
It has a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
Absolutely. And the same with Wildcats.
For sure.
Wildcats, obviously a little bit newer, originally came out by Jim Lee and Brandon Choi, and the artist was Brett Booth in 1992.
Wow, really?
There have been a... Yep.
I didn't know it was Brett Booth. That's crazy.
There have been a ton more iterations on Wildcats since then, though.
Right.
And tons of different team lineups, and there's like an SNES game, and there's a TV show, and all sorts of stuff like that. So Wildcats a little bit more timely, a little bit more relevant, especially spinning out of Warren Ellis' Wildstorm.
Which is ending.
Yes, and Wildcats is starting. Ellis is writing it with Ramon Villalobos on art. I'm very excited for it. It's only a 6-issue miniseries, but I think that Ellis and Villalobos can bring some real cool kinetic energy to it. And I kind of like the idea that Ellis, in an interview about it, said, "It's only 6 issues. I might kill them all."
Right.
I was like, you know, that seems pretty fun.
It's also worth noting, I think, Tamara Bonvillain's doing the color. So this is the art team that was on
Bordertown. Yes.
Sorry, I have a cold. I can't think.
I do as well. So, Tamara is now an Eisner Award-nominated colorist.
Yes.
So.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, I'm really excited for that one, especially the art team on that. I mean, I've always loved Alice, but the art team on that's going to make it pop, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad to see that they're back together and working on something.
For sure.
And quickly, relatively quickly.
Oh, yeah. Only a few months now. Yep. Some other things that came out from the DC solicits. The Green Lanterns of the Universe is coming. That's interesting. In The Green Lantern number 10 by Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp, according to the solicit, they have to save a dying multiverse.
Huh.
Defeat the relentless Anti-Man and embark upon their quest for the Cosmic Grail.
Well, that sounds like Grant Morrison.
That's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
And if you Google it, you can find the art. It's a very eclectic-looking Green Lantern core. There's actually a Green Lantern that looks like Batman. There's a Green Lantern with a rainbow, upside-down rainbow triangle on her chest. And a mohawk that's also rainbow.
Cool.
And then there's like a hippie. I don't know. There's a devil guy? I don't know, man. There's a lot going on.
Cool.
That's pretty cool.
I I judged an academic conference at the university I work for this past week.
Yeah.
And one of the students that I judged a presentation for, she did a presentation on Morrison's and Frank Quietly's We Three. And talked kind of at length about the difference between companionship and consumerism in human and animal relationships, and used the graphic novel to really get into that. And it really made me want to read some Morrison. So I've been thinking about whenever the first trade of his Green Lantern comes out, I'm going to pick that up.
Yeah, for sure.
So knowing that it is also kind of expanding makes me even more inclined.
Oh, yeah, I really liked We Three. I have it on a shelf somewhere, although it's really sad.
It is incredibly sad. Yeah.
There was talk of them.
I don't think Green Lantern is as sad.
No, definitely is not. No. Yeah. It's more of like a space epic opera.
Yeah.
Space opera?
And that sounds cool.
Over in Flash, Joshua Williamson is going to be telling a story called Death of the Speed Force. What? But you just came out with the Sage Force and the other force with a name that I can't remember. He just recently came out
name
with the fact
force?
That there's multiple forces. So if the Speed Force dies, what will happen? Oh, no. So it sounds like DC's doing some the big mover and a shaker kind of things.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Absolutely. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, and they're also bringing back Young Animal.
Yes.
So they're really, you know, they canceled a bunch of stuff all at once.
Yes.
And I was like,
Yeah, that's a bad sign.
It was kind of obvious ones, like Scooby-Doo Apocalypse.
Yeah, although that was going on for a while.
Yeah, and it was successful, but it was also kind of the same with Walking Dead, where I was like, I regrettably, as much as I'm enjoying it, think that this has served its purpose. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But then other books kind of started to fall, too, or get pushed back infinitely. Heroes in Crisis and Doomsday Clock and anything on Black Label. And I was a little bit worried about where DC was headed. But they're really bringing an interesting deck for the next year, next couple months.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I am not worried about them at all.
Well, comics are ending next week. But aside from that.
I thought
that,
it was next week. Yeah. Darn. So over on ABC, a new show coming out called Stumptown, which is based on the Oni Press series by Greg Rucka and Matthew Southworth.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty dope.
Yeah, it seems cool. It's a crazy get.
Yeah.
And it's actually scheduled to air Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific, starring Colby Smulders as Dex Perios, a strong, assertive, and sharp-witted Army veteran with a complicated love life, gambling debt, and a brother to take care of in Portland, Oregon. Her military intelligence makes her a great PI, but her unapologetic style puts her in the firing line of hardcore criminals and not quite in alliance with the police. Stumptown has always reminded me a little bit of Jessica Jones.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
I wouldn't say that they're like the same book or the same character or anything like that, right. But it gives me that same kind of like cool, gritty, but also heroic edge, street level heroism.
Right.
Right. And I think Ruck is a really good writer. I think the art on that series is fantastic. I think it is really well suited to be channeled into a really cool individual visual style.
Right.
And if ABC can nail that, I think it'll be really successful.
I think it's going to help the industry if it does be successful, because not to compare it to other indie stories like this, but there are a lot of indie stories like this that could be adapted, and I think it'll maybe pique the interest of studios.
Mm-hmm.
I know that
absolutely.
Rosenberg said something on Twitter about his adapting his bank heist comic.
Yes, he's writing a film script for Four Kids Walk Into a Bank.
Right, and then we know Donny Cates, I think he's finished writing the script for God
Country.
Yes, God Country.
Yeah, the Dark Horse book. Yeah.
I bring those up because those are also indie stories, and they're getting attention from studios, and the more this happens, the better, I think, for comic industry.
Mm-hmm. And kind of what we talked about last week, where we were saying it's really difficult to get these stories greenlit if you don't have a good partner.
Right.
ABC, obviously being owned by Disney, is a good partner. And so I'm really happy to see an indie book like this get picked up by a partner that has the capital and the resources to make it interesting and to actually do something worthwhile with it.
Mm-hmm.
Despite growing concerns about a monopoly on properties.
It's only getting worse, folks.
Yes.
Well, that's the end of our news segment. I hope you enjoyed it. And we're going to be moving on to our top books of last week, our top two favorite books that came out last week. To start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com and the critic and fan highest rated book from last week. The critic book, I am shocked to see this because I've only seen it on our list 15 times before. Gideon Falls, number 13, with a 9.8, written by Jeff Lemire and art by Andrea Sorrentino. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then the fan pick was Little Bird, number 3, with a 10. Ooh, boy.
A perfect score. 10 out of 10.
Ari Bard, who writes for APGComics.com, he reviewed it for APGComics.com, and he, I think, gave it a 10. Yep, he had to have given it a 10 for math reasons. Well, no, that's not actually true, because this is the fan category.
This is the fan category. But I believe the critic reviews had it up a 9.8 or a 9.7.
Nice.
So really high up there, and there were a substantial number of critic reviews. So
the art on this book is insane. Ian Bertram is doing a great job.
Amazing. Yeah.
We both haven't read it, but we need to.
Yeah, I recently read and reviewed the library edition of Ian Bertram's House of Penance,
mm-hmm.
Which came out from Dark Horse a while ago, and
yep.
I really, really love that. And you know, I saw Little Bird coming out, and I had said previously on the show, and I've said it a couple times now, that I was going to wait for the trade, but I'll just go pick up the single issues.
Yeah, yeah. Support the creators.
Yeah. And you know, if that means that it turns into a hardcover or an artist collection or something at some point in time, I'll probably get that too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, DC's like re-released their what's it called? Shoot. Mr. Miracle. It's now like in its like third format.
Yeah.
I was shocked to see there's a hardcover now. It's like, what? When will it end?
I kind of wonder if that's a game to get as many Eisner nominations as possible.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
It could work.
I wonder if it does.
You know what will help get Eisner nominations? Hearing your second favorite book from last week.
Ah, The Forest J. Hollingsworth Bump. Of course.
Mm-hmm.
My second favorite book of last week was Spider-Man and the League of Realms number 1, written by Sean Ryan with art by Nico Leone. This was my pick last week. This is the book I was most excited about. And I think, I may be wrong, we're 21 deep. Our podcast can't drink, but I can. I think that this may be the first time where I've picked a book and then it has been one of my top books the next week. It's a really fantastic, fun War of the Realms tie-in about Spider-Man leading a team of warriors from all of the other realms.
Not just one realm?
Not just one realm. I think there's everyone except for the Dark Elves, which are obviously kind of the antagonistic force in War of the Realms. It's a really fun book for that purpose. You know, I think Spider-Man is kind of the quintessential, for lack of a better word, normal guy hero,
mm-hmm.
in that he's typically best written when he's on the street. He cares about people. He often worries about what the normal people around him are thinking or are doing. He really embodies the kind of I don't kill people heroism.
Yes.
To me, way more than a lot of Marvel characters do, and certainly a lot more than a lot of DC characters do. And this issue really touches on why that is the core of Spidey's character. He goes out of his way in the middle of like a crazy cool battle scene to help some people out. And it ends up turning the tide of this battle, which could otherwise go just as badly as things have gone in Brooklyn or Manhattan or, I mean, it seems like the whole rest of the world during War of the Realms. And it totally kind of flips it and turns one of the cards that Malekith is really reliant on against him. In a really unexpected way, but also in a way that is honest and true to who Peter Parker is.
Mm-hmm.
The art is really fun and bombastic. You have Spidey driving around in a buggy and stuff. So it was good. It was funny. It was lighthearted, but it was also a little bit sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what I want out of a Spider-Man story. And I think Sean Ryan hit that note just right for me.
Yeah, it had some nice humorous moments too, like with the car driving in the earlier scenes.
A lot of name calling and stuff too, because he can't be bothered to learn the names of any of the people that are with him.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I think he ends up calling the giant lady.
It's almost like that where you're like, yeah. Wait, but Peter's a genius. How, what?
Yeah. He's got the, like, mask on, mask off personality type thing.
Oh, that's true. Oh, yeah. Never thought of it that way. That's cool.
Yeah.
My second favorite book was Star Wars TIE Fighter No. 2 by Jody Hauser and Roge Antonio. This is obviously the second issue in a interesting series focused on TIE Fighter pilots, the bad guys. And I really liked the first issue. I reviewed this and the first issue for APGComics.com. The biggest takeaway, and it's kind of a spoiler, is there's a twist where you find out the enemy isn't who you thought it was. You thought it was the rebels, but it's not. And it's a fascinating twist because we've never really seen this in any of the movies. I haven't watched any of the cartoons, so I could be wrong on there. But I haven't seen it in any of the comics, and I've read most of those. And on top of that, Antonio is doing an amazing job with the art in a creative, clever ways to show the faces of the TIE fighter pilots. Now, mm-hmm. as we know, yeah. they're all wearing these oxygen masks, like out of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And in two different ways in this issue alone, he does this thing where it's like translucent, but there's still like an outline of the mask. So we can see their like, oh, shocked face.
Oh, yeah. Very cool.
And then later he uses like a sort of like a word bubble with an arrow to show you like in a dogfight scene, like which character is in each TIE fighter. Anyway, it's just when you see clever ideas like that in a comic, you go, oh, wait, there was a problem that he solved that it, you know, it wouldn't occur to you unless you like stop and think about it. But like, I don't know, it's kind of a neat idea. A neat little thing I noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that does make me kind of think back to the movies and think. Although I like those scenes, they are kind of incomprehensible.
Right.
Like, you get the shot of Luke in the X-Wing, and then there's a shot of all the X-Wings together in formation, and I have no idea which one Luke is in.
Right.
And obviously that's a limitation of the film, but it doesn't have to be a limitation of the comic, right? And that makes perfect sense.
And yeah. since you brought that up, like, you see Luke's face because it's not covered. How much you want to bet at one point George Lucas was like, oh, they're all going to have masks. Just like yeah. all the, you know, World War II pilots. But then they were like, wait, but we need to see Luke's face.
Absolutely.
I think Marvel's done a fantastic job with their Star Wars books. But I am going to say I'm bringing up something in my soapbox later about the Star Wars comics.
Mm.
What's your favorite book from last week?
My favorite book from last week is Spider-Man Life Story No. 3, written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Mark Bagley. Man, I could have told you this was going to be my favorite book of the week when it was solicited mm-hmm. a while ago.
I wonder why.
And that is solely because it has the symbiote suit, which is like my favorite thing in hero books. And it has art by Mark Bagley, who I think is kind of the quintessential symbiote artist. Obviously, McFarlane has also contributed a lot to that. And I think we discussed seeing a conversation about that on Twitter. But Bagley has done just so much for that cool, sinister, sloppy, sleek look. And it's really like untouched as far as I'm concerned. This story, the way that Zdarsky is writing Life Story, given that Spidey is aging or Petery. Is aging in real time throughout the decades, right? And now that we're into the 80s, he's what, in his 40s, 30s, maybe?
Yeah, because it was the first issue yeah. was 69, I think.
Yeah. So he's aging in real time. People have dropped in and out of his life, and great tragedy has happened to him. I feel comfortable spoiling the last issue now, where he finds out that through kind of a twist of the Jackal, that the real Gwen Stacy has died in a kind of cloning accident, which I thought was a great way to totally change your expectations of how one of the most famous twists in comic books writing of all time. I thought that was a great way to re-envision it and rewrite it and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that this issue is a really great way of saying we never really spent enough time on how Peter felt about that. And I think that that's largely because people didn't like it and it needed to go away quickly and it was wildly unpopular, rightfully so, probably. But what would happen if Peter was just absolutely wrecked by grief, if Mary's mental health was, or Mary's, well, actually Mary a little bit, but I actually meant May. May's mental health was declining at the same rate that Pete's was, mm-hmm. you know, as they age kind of in parallel to each other. And then MJ is there as well, and she's not dealing with kind of being the emotional and familial anchor point for Peter. And so the symbiote, in a much more realistic and reasonable sense, and in a much scarier sense than in the original comics, in the original storyline, latches on to Peter. And it feels so worthwhile and so resonant and emotionally relevant and earned here after just two issues that Zdarsky has been writing. And with Bagley's art to back that up, you know, this final twist that, like, he's got this big gaping mouth full of teeth like Venom does, but it's Peter. It feels really, really, really earned. And I cannot ever have told you that I would have expected that from this story, and it goes to really dark places.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, you hit a nail on the head on that last comment. Like, I don't know what's going to happen next. Zdarsky's like just going all out with this new timeline, and it's strayed so far from what we know that anything could happen mm-hmm. at this point.
Right, right. Well, also, I think doing a great job of retaining the emotional highs and visual elements that are true to Spidey,
mm-hmm.
But totally revisioning them, right?
Right.
And that's really hard to do. I have no idea what is going to happen in the next issue, like you said, but I can guarantee I'm picking it up the day it comes out.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Two Spidey books this week, and I think for very different reasons.
Last week, I think all four of our books were Spider-Man, weren't they? Or no? Maybe not, but it did show up like in multiple places.
Yeah. League of the Realms is really funny. It's really kind of lighthearted. And Sean gets like really into the like, Peter is quippy and he's fun and he cares about people and stuff. And Life Story goes the other way, which is like, Peter is overburdened by power and responsibility, and it is just on the edge of breaking him. And if he had aged in real time and tragedy happened to him in real time, he wouldn't be the same person.
He's going to be bitter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And both feel totally worthwhile and relevant to me, and that's absolutely crazy for a character that came out in the 60s, right?
Yeah, that's true.
What was your number one pick?
I'm going to go with Justice League number 24. I'm a broken record. I keep picking Scott Snyder and Jorge Jimenez's fantastic series. This arc has been excellent. It's still going. I feel like I've been talking about it for 2 or 3 months now, even though this is a bi-weekly book. Every issue has really well-written dialogue that cues you into the characters. But this arc in particular is just balls-to-the-wall fun. And I think I said in my review at aptcomics.com of this issue, it's a reminder of that comics can and probably should be fun. And that goes for even emotional moments. There's a scene early on with Superman where he mentions where Clark talks about how Lois came up with this term called gray kryptonite, which is this sort of sad moment, or this sort of... when you're like down on your luck, it's gray kryptonite. It's just like a cute kind of fun little idea that gets you thinking, and mm-hmm. it actually makes the characters feel more real. If your wife knew that green kryptonite could kill you, you know, put a little play on that, call it gray kryptonite. You know, even though green kryptonite would literally kill him, I mean, it just adds a little levity to their lives.
Sure. Yeah.
And then later, there's like crazy ideas in here. Like, for instance, we're in like an alternate dimension in this story. And in this story, Lois Lane is actually like the warden of a prison where they put everyone who ever has or will commit a crime. And we learn that they use the technology in Superman's, when he was a baby, the spaceship that kept him in stasis.
Sure, yeah.
Apparently
the baby pod.
Yeah, apparently that thing kept him in stasis, but also allowed him to like learn things, I guess. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, it taught him about Earth and stuff right. while he was headed there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But we find out that they've reverse engineered this technology so that they can put prisoners in stasis forever. Right. It's like the word. It's again. It's like Minority Report in that, right? Like you're sort of frozen in time and you don't know what's going on anymore. They've taken control of your brain. And that's just two little things that happen in this one issue.
Yeah, that's a lot.
There's one or two really cool ideas like that in every issue. And every time I put the book down, I think, God, Snyder is just infusing it with all of his ideas. But then he surprises me the next issue with another cool idea.
Mm-hmm,
and it's ideas like this that I think another writer would maybe have every few issues, and it might even be built up to be an even bigger element. But instead, like this idea of using the kryptonite technology, or sorry, the Krypton technology to like make a prison, that could be like a whole arc, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile,
yeah, I think it's really, really difficult to throw everything at the wall and see right. what sticks uh-huh. and see that most of your ideas stick.
Yeah, for sure.
And have to write to each of them. That's really hard to
do. On top of all that, Jimenez designs yet another wicked awesome costume, this time for Batman, which is actually similar to the Superman costume, the new Superman costume that he introduced a few issues ago, where it's like white with this gold, almost like gold leaf accents on it. It's really cool. But it's also like a mech suit that Batman like wears or is inside of controlling.
Mm.
And it's on the last page of the issue and it's like, oh shit, it's about to go down. Gets you excited.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. What did Pokemon say? What did Pikachu say? I mean, he said it gets you in the jigglies.
Yeah, you can feel it in your jellies.
In your jellies.
Yes, the good detective said that.
Jigglies is probably a little inappropriate.
I don't know that jellies is any more appropriate.
You're right.
Yeah.
What a dirty little Pokemon. In our next segment.
I really wish they'd voiced him by Danny DeVito.
Who was wasn't there an actor that they were going to, they tried out, but it didn't work out?
Well, there was a fan petition to have him voiced by DeVito.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And some people took some footage from the game, the Detective Pikachu game, and put DeVito's voice lines from Always Sunny in Philadelphia over it. So there's a part where Pikachu's bending over and saying, oh, whoops, I dropped my Magnum condom for my monster dong.
Oh, my God.
And stuff like that, which I just... probably incongruent for a kid's movie.
No, yeah.
But oh boy, I would have loved it.
Yeah, there was some actor that I've read, like, they didn't say who it was, but they said they literally had them record lines that were that close to using them. And then
Yeah. Apparently there's enough outtakes from the Ryan Reynolds version that they could do an R-rated movie.
Wow, that's cool.
Which I would love to see, since it really did kind of feel like PG Deadpool.
For sure. But it was really funny.
Yeah.
That was our Pokemon segment. Next segment, Super Fight, where we take a DC character and have that character fight a Marvel character, but we use the card game Super Fight.
Yes, I have the yellow deck, the challenge deck from the Super Fight card game. Not a sponsor, but we'd be happy to have you.
Hell yeah.
And I will pick a challenge randomly that they're going to do.
All right, I'm
going to
pick a DC character. Ready?
And I'll pick a Marvel character.
Excited?
I'm scared.
What are you scared of?
I don't know. Just general anticipation. All right.
I got Ra's al Ghul.
I got Rocket Raccoon.
Oh, man.
And they are going to be fighting over who would be a better infomercial spokesperson.
Wow.
So Ra's al Ghul and Rocket Raccoon. Who do you think you would be more likely to buy the...
ShamWow.
I was going to say the Slap Chop. Yeah.
Or what's that workout grip thing? Like a dumbbell. Shake Weight.
Or P90X.
Shake Weight.
There's all sorts of them. Fuck. OxyClean. All right. So ShamWow.
All right. I'm going to say Roz will be better because we know he has good management skills. He keeps his ninjas in order, and they all do his bidding. With just a flick of the eye, they'll do whatever he wants. I'm sure that he could go on camera and be like, "Y'all need this ShamWow." He wouldn't say y'all, but he definitely could sell it to us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to keep a G. Rocket can't do that. Rocket's going to be swearing. He's going to get taken off the air.
So here's the thing about Rocket.
Okay.
And it actually ties perfectly into our little Detective Pikachu derail earlier.
Yeah.
I don't think I would think Rocket is a real person.
Uh-huh.
I would be like, oh, what a cute, weird mascot.
Oh, okay.
Right? I would be like, wow, that's great character design.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Oh, he's like a little raccoon. He's cleaning up his house. I think that I would be like, that's really cute. I think Roz would come out and be speaking in fucking haikus.
Yeah, he definitely, like, he'd have some kind of orb. Look into the orb.
Right. He'd be like, to elevate yourself, ring out the sham wow now.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, some sort of weird shit that maybe it would do like a little bit of hypnotism on people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, maybe that works.
But when these things air, you're going to fall asleep if you act like that.
Yeah, I don't think it would work on everyone.
You need energy and pizzazz.
Yeah, you need Rocket. The trick, the built-in conceit with Rocket is that he loves his guns.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to convince Rocket to not go on screen with guns.
Yeah, that's going to be hard.
Unless they're targeting specifically the NRA demographic.
Yeah, if he's selling AK-47s, it's going to be going right as rain.
I don't know, like, what the cross-section is between people that buy AK-47s and ShamWows or the number of people in the NRA that also have a ShamWow.
Yeah.
It could be high, but I don't think that it is.
Quick, everyone, Google. Find the trend.
There's probably some metric on that somewhere.
Probably.
I bet the NRA or ShamWow has done research.
Well, how many Russians have want both? Go from there.
I think that if they could convince Rocket to drop the guns, even for one commercial, which they could probably do by persuading him to get a bunch of money.
Right.
Right, because that's kind of his other... He's basically a little rodent pirate.
Right.
I think he would knock it out the park.
Now, if they were in the same studio, side by side, trying to sell at the same time,
ooh,
how does that go down? I feel like Roz is going to get really frustrated really fast.
Yeah. It kind of depends on if he can get into Rocket's head, right?
Mm-hmm. The problem with Roz is, like, he comes with the ninja order people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The shadow.
He's got an entourage.
League of Assassins.
Yeah.
You can't think of the League of... I mean, I guess for this experiment, though, you can't think of the League of Assassins
being involved. Oh, my God.
What?
What if Ra's al Ghul used the ShamWow to clean up the Lazarus Pit?
Ah, that's funny.
That would blow my mind.
I mean, Rocket could use it to clean up the ship. We do know that there's...
True.
Don't take a blacklight into the ship by any means possible.
Right, that's true. I think just like Detective Pikachu, right? Like, and unlike Sonic.
Yeah.
I think Rocket's got a good design. I think... I would be like, oh, he's cute.
Yeah.
He's got a little suit. He's got a little towel.
Like the cheese goblins.
Yeah. Are you talking about Cheddar Goblin from...
Yeah. In our next segment, top books for next week, we talk about our number one book we can't wait to read, folks. My most anticipated book for next week is The Flash number 71 by Joshua Williamson and Howard Porter. This is the year one story that he's doing. Last week it ended, or not last week, 2 weeks ago, issue number 70 ended in a cliffhanger, which wasn't a big surprise because I don't want to spoil it. Time travel is a thing that Flash does. Anyway, that's a huge twist on the story, and it's taking place with a version of Barry where he's just learning about his abilities, and I can't wait to see how it pans out from there.
Yeah, I love the imagery they've been using in Flash sitting on top of a pile of like burnt out shoes,
yeah
stuff like that. I think it's really cool. I think it's really inventive, and I really love that stuff. Like I was saying, for Daredevil grabbing the sword that Heimdall uses a couple weeks ago, like just the stuff that like we take for granted for a character,
right,
that is actually totally worth delving into.
Mm-hmm.
I think Williamson has been doing a really good job of that
for sure. What are you looking forward to?
I am looking forward to Marvel Comics Presents number 5. Writers on this include Charles Soule and Chris Claremont. Artists include Paulo Sequeira and Luke Ross. The cover art is by Arthur Adams. This is a 1980s Marvel-style stories. It's got Wolverine's first Vigil, Nightcrawler mid-cross-time caper at the Berlin Wall, and then finally, a pivotal Venom tale by fan favorite creators Leah Williams and Guillermo Sanna.
Nice.
And that is the one that I'm really excited about, because Leah Williams said on Twitter, "Hey, all you people that want to fuck Venom, all you horny Venom fuckers, I wrote a horny Venom story in Marvel Comics Presents number 5.
Give the people what they want.
I'm not saying that I want to fuck Venom. I'm just saying that I want to read the story.
All right.
And those two things can exist separately.
I agree. I thought you picked this because of Claremont.
Hey, we don't got to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with wanting to fuck Venom. I do have a lot of Venom action figures.
Yeah, I have a whole, I have a case, and it has a Venom or symbiotes get a whole shelf.
So I'm very excited. And obviously, like, that's going to play really well, given how many people were shipping Eddie and the symbiote and stuff.
Yeah, I hope they go all in with it, too.
And are eager for that, missing it in Donny Cates' story.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. And right now, you can't get Venom, like the traditional Venom, because the symbiote is apart from Eddie in War of the Realms.
Yeah, there are two Venoms in War of the Realms, which is interesting.
So this will give you your Venom fix, so to speak.
A coming soapbox on that, probably.
What, the War of the Realms split, or how they're treating the character?
The War of the Realms split, most likely. Uh-huh. But this will give me my Venom fix. It will also give me my Venom fuck fix.
Oh my gosh. Sounds good. Came right out with it, folks. He's not beating around the bush. No. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we talk about our favorite cover art coming out next week.
Yes.
What is your favorite cover art?
My favorite cover art is for Martian Manhunter number 5, which is also one of my favorite series coming out right now. It's written by Steve Orlando with illustrations by Riley Rossmo. The cover art by Riley Rossmo is also fantastic, but I have chosen the variant cover by Joshua Middleton, which has the kind of main villain that has just been revealed on the series, Charn, a all-red alien-looking figure with bug eyes and a big open maw of a mouth, sharp yellow teeth, clawed hands on the left and the right-hand side bleeding into the frame. He looks like he's mentally tormenting John Jones, the detective that Zon Zones, the Martian Manhunter, has taken the form of. There are various pictures of John Jones's face juxtaposed over Charn with red leading lines kind of wavy as if he's in his mind toying around with him. There's a bit of a space imagery over it too, like blackness with white pockmarks, some green and red planets. It's almost monochromatic. There's a little bit of gold, black, red, and green. But there's a lot of depth and dynamic energy to it, and I like it a lot, almost as much as I like the story.
Big Martian energy.
BME.
It's a dope cover, I have to say.
Yeah.
My cover, though,
pretty rad.
Straight up, is better than your cover.
Okay.
And I didn't even make it. My cover is from Tony Stark, Iron Man number 11 by Alexander Lozano. And it is freaking crazy. It's Iron Man almost fully on the page. Really no background, because you don't need background when there's so much detail. There's like robotic tentacles coming out of his, bursting out of his back, bursting out of his arms. He's clearly like screaming, maybe in pain. He's got his hands are balled up in fists, and he's like in this pose where it's like, damn, technology is killing Tony. When usually Tony's killing technology, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's hyper-realistic, but at the same time, not. It's almost like cyberpunk.
Yeah, I think it's got a bit of like a techno-organic thing too. A little bit of like H.R. Giger.
I was going to say that. Yeah, it's got this almost like technology meets organic, and it's got that kind of weird sexiness to it, even though it is very horrific, the cover. I'm almost surprised Marvel approved this, because it is it's kind of a scary cover, especially for a book like Iron Man.
Yeah, that's true. I like the direction that they're taking the book in. I think it's cool. They had a cover not too long ago where he was being crushed by ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah, that was really nice. Callback to his
alcoholism, and I think I chose that.
You did, yeah.
I think that was an Alex Ross cover, actually. I may be wrong. But yeah, they seem to be really going all out with this. And I love that Marvel's greenlighting it.
For sure.
It's cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you wouldn't, I don't know, 15 years ago, I don't think Marvel would have approved something, not only this artistic, but out there.
Yeah, it's very stylized.
Yeah.
And it's really dark.
It's a stark contrast to DC, where they have the, you know, the word bubble balloon covers, characters sort of being a little bit more cute in all ages. But then that's neither here nor there, because in our next segment, I get on a soapbox and talk about Star Wars. So you better listen up. I'm about to teach y'all something that clearly Forrest is already trying to defame me. I haven't even said a word yet.
I can see it in the show notes. Go ahead. Go off, I guess.
I was a huge Dark Horse Star Wars fan. I was reading most of their books for years. And one thing that, you know, caught me off guard when Marvel started doing their own Star Wars books is that Marvel did all their books post-New Hope, pre-Empire. All the stories were taking place in this, like, one slice. And for years now, it's been mostly that period. Save for probably a small short story in an anthology or something like that. I could be wrong. But mostly it's focused in that one time frame. And after reading Dark Horse stories, which they were, you know, they were publishing Star Wars books for decades, they captured every inch of history, including the far, far future, where Han Solo's like daughter or daughter's daughter was like the main character. I forget. That was a really good book, though. It was one of the first books I reviewed for the site, actually. Anyway, I think the line is stronger if all the books are taking place in the same period. And recently, we've seen it stray a little bit from that, particularly with the Age of Rebellion books that Greg Pak did. For instance, he did one on Princess Leia, and it takes place just before Return of the Jedi, when she goes to save Han.
Yeah.
And none of the main books have been going in that realm at all. And it makes it feel very strange and apart from the whole, whereas all the books have been post-Hope, pre-Empire, and makes them feel like a cohesive universe. I can go pick up a Star Wars book, and I know, without having to check, that it's probably pre-Empire. And that gets my mindset for where it fits into the grander scheme. Because as we all know, these books are in canon. These books are part of the real story that we've seen on screen. I'm worried that they're going to stray out of pre-Empire too soon. Or at least if they do change the timeline and move to a different era, have all the books do so. Have all the books be in that era at the same time. And that's it. That's my opinion. And I'm on the internet, and that's all that matters.
Not as inflammatory as I was expecting.
Because I'm an inflammatory guy.
But I still disagree. Go off, I guess.
Why do you disagree?
I want people to tell stories they're interested in telling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a editorial mandate to fit all of the stories into one time frame, especially for a universe like Star Wars, would put a kind of vice grip on stories that people like Greg Pak and Jody Hauser and stuff haven't been able to tell before and are really excited about telling, and I want to see the stories that they want to tell. Obviously, they're subject to having to do a pitch and a little bit of editorial meddling and stuff like that, but the Star Wars brand being under Marvel is still relatively new.
Oh, for sure.
And they have a lot of creators that are getting into Star Wars or being able to tell Star Wars stories for the first time. And while those two things are happening, or while that cross section is happening, I don't want a unilateral rule that takes away creators' energy or interest in telling very specific stories that they want to tell.
It all started in 2015 when Marvel got the license back.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's when you started being wrong? I agree.
Well, no, because they didn't really start dabbling in other timelines until the prequel books recently. I suppose the...
Yeah, did the, that's true.
Do you know if the Charles Soule's Lando series was pre-Empire? I forget.
I haven't read it.
I love that. That miniseries was amazing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. Yeah, here's the thing. I mean, what if the main Star Wars book... Now, obviously, it's telling a linear narrative, so it's not going to jump to freaking post-Last Jedi.
And Dr. Aphra is as well.
What's that?
Dr. Aphra is as well.
As well what?
Also telling a linear... Mm. A linear...
Right. And so is Darth Vader, or has been.
Right. So I think that those books exist.
Right. I just think it'd be confusing if there's a Kylo Ren... long-term series, like, you know, ongoing, I was what I meant. Mm-hmm. As well as Star Wars, like, the main book. The main book obviously can't jump around.
Jump around.
Or maybe it can. I don't know.
Jump around.
Can Greg Pak take issue number 70 and go, okay, now everything is post-Return of the Jedi? Probably not. I mean, that's got to be mandated.
I mean, I think it would be a hard sell, right?
Yeah.
And then if you do that to all the Star Wars books... I worry, and I don't know with any evidence, that it would take out some of their enjoyment and excitement about telling Star Wars stories.
Based on the fact that they've, for almost 4 years, or for 4 years now, Marvel's kept most of their main ongoing series in the Star Wars universe at the same time, pre-Empire, it gives me the impression they don't want to, like, overtax, not overtax, they don't want to, they don't want to... I keep thinking of a very sexual term, but I can't say that.
Oh.
They don't want to give it away too quickly. You know what I mean? Like they want to stretch this out. They're playing the long game here, so they don't have to jump to post Empire pre Return for any time soon, because you know maybe that's for later. I mean, there is the Poe Dameron comic, which was semi-ongoing. I mean, it's over now.
Yeah, and I think that there are probably going to be comics as soon as Rise of Skywalker is out as well.
I'm thinking about, like, Star Wars, Darth Vader. Those books are all pre-Empire, and then a lot of the other sort of miniseries at the time, too. Anyway.
I think that your point is valid and also wrong.
How dare you?
No, I'm kidding.
How dare you?
It didn't make me as angry as I expected when I saw it on the
I notes. Love how you were prepared to be angry, though. I like that.
I was prepared to be pissed.
Tell me, is my off-topic top shelf pick also wrong?
No.
Which is Rammstein's new album, self-titled Rammstein, is amazing. The freaking album is sick. I got to listen to it early for reasons, and I've been listening to it off and on all week. I've been sick, obviously, so I haven't been, like... jamming too much, but I have to say, and I was thinking about this a lot. I was actually playing Du Hast for my girlfriend the other day because I was like, "Did you like Du Hast when it came out?" And she was like, "What? What is this?"
Du Hast, Misty.
She had no idea, and I thought it was the biggest song in the world when it came out. I thought, and I loved that song when it came out. And I was thinking about why I like this song, that song, and why I like this new album. And I think it's because Rammstein is delivering stadium rock. So similar to Queen, not the same music, obviously. But it's music that a stadium can like do. You know, it just gets you into.
And obviously, their stage shows are built for that, right? Too, they know that to a certain degree.
Right? I was watching some footage of an old show they did, and the keyboardist was on a treadmill.
Yep. Yeah. they have a specific song that's about cannibalism, where one of them gets into a giant boiling pot, and the other ones walk around in chef costumes and. Put torches under the pot.
That's funny. And stuff. They're like guar, but
they
less
obviously
intense.
Know that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Their look is interesting. It's almost like Mad Max when they're on stage, I mean.
Yeah. It's very industrial.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I highly recommend listening to this album. I think everyone else is too. I was Googling a little bit before the show, and like every review is like, oh my God, it's so good.
It's been a long time since an album from them has come out. 10 years?
Yeah, and the lead singer is 56. I mean... They're no spring chickens, but...
You know, he... interesting fact about him.
Yeah.
He was training to be, or was also selected to be, a German Olympic swimmer.
Wow.
And then he was like, I don't think I really want to do this.
Huh.
and ended up being a the singer for Rammstein.
Just like Jason Statham.
Just like Jason
Statham. He was an Olympic diver.
And now he's the singer of Rammstein.
Now we've connected action hero star Jason Statham to the lead singer of Rammstein. Actually, you know, the Rolling Stones are going on tour again.
Mm. Yes.
Like, are they going to do a tour, like, from, like, a hospital at some point?
Have everyone come to
them.
They're
so old. It's crazy.
They are.
I respect them more every time they do a new tour. Because every time they do a tour, I'm like, oh, that's the last one.
I think Ozzy's tour this summer is going to be his last
one. Oh, I didn't know he was touring.
Yes, he is, with Megadeth.
Wow. That should be good.
I think Megadeth is opening and then also playing for him.
Oh, interesting.
Which sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the end of our show, folks. Thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, review, and share. We appreciate that you listen. We appreciate you keep coming back. And we love you. Mm-hmm. Do you love them, Forrest?
I love Venom.
Oh, he sure does, folks. Thanks for listening.
I love you.